It is now 8:30 a.m. here at KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org.
This is Free Will in Franklin. How y'all doing out there? We're about to start our special Block the Boat coverage. It seems the ship got word of our activism and the boat has turned around. So small victory now. And we have moved the demonstration here to KPFA. We're about to hand it over to our video broadcast. I want to remind everybody that we are video broadcasting at kpfa.org. Go to that spot and then go to the left, click on the video channel, and you'll be able to watch our event. We're all live here in the KPFA studios. I'm going to throw it over to Dennis Bernstein, Sarah B., and take it away.
Protests continued, but there was, as Franklin said, a major victory. A major victory in that the boat has stopped its forward progress. That's already costing the company money. And we're going to hear a lot about what happened this morning. We're going to get a report from the dock. But joining us first is Reem Asil. Reem is a main organizer, lead organizer for Block the Boat. She works with many organizations here in the Bay Area working for the liberation of Palestine. Welcome to this special.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you to lean right into that microphone, speak up nice and loud. Why don't you bring us up to speed in terms of what happened with the boat? Why is it now docked somewhere off Santa Cruz?
So for viewers and listeners who are just tuning in over the last few weeks, a coalition of over 70 organizations have been working hard to mobilize to bring a diverse set of people all over Oakland to block one of the most prominent shipping companies in Israel, the Zim Shipping Line, from unloading its goods at the port of Oakland. This is sending a message to the world that the people of Oakland does not welcome any economic or diplomatic ties to anything doing with the state of Israel. It's sending a clear message that we will not stand complicit with business as usual with Israel. And as a result of our successful organizing over the last few weeks, we were able to actually delay and block the ship from coming into the port of Oakland. So we already consider this an early victory. Zim has heard our message loud and clear. And so instead of 5 a.m. this morning, we are calling on folks to come out at 3 o'clock p.m. today. We are sending a message again to the Zim Shipping Lines that we are serious about our efforts to block any commerce from happening at the Port of Oakland. So we consider this an early victory. As the ship lays stalled out on the ocean, it's losing money by the minute. It is a clear victory for us that there is no business as usual with the Port of Oakland, right? That we will not stand by as the Israeli shipping company continues to do business with the Port of Oakland.
And a little bit later on in the broadcast, we're going to get deeply engaged with why people are involved here, what this mm-hmm. movement is all about. Mm-hmm. Beyond blocking the boat, which, right. as you say, was a bit of a victory. And again, remind people, so there was supposed to be an action this morning.
Correct.
The boat didn't show up. So people, for the most part, didn't show up. A lot of people were actually there. We're going to hear about from one of them in a moment. But again, what are you asking people to do today, tomorrow? I think the latest information we have is the boat's supposed to, if it ever arrives, tomorrow.
Right. We're asking folks to come out with the utmost discipline at 3 o'clock p.m., just as we asked them to come out at 5 a.m. We know, we always have a saying that we'll always be one step ahead, right, that our organizing, that we are steadfast in our struggle. And so we need to make sure that that ship doesn't come in. So it's really important that everybody who is coming out at 5 a.m. Not only come out at 3 p.m., but bring their friends, bring their family. We know that 5 a.m. was a hard time. This is a victory for us because we can even bring out more people. So we're asking folks to meet at the West Oakland BART at 3 p.m. We will be marching en masse. We will have a huge audience, right, in West Oakland and in the Port of Oakland. So we need to make our message loud and clear that the Zim Shipping Company is not welcome at 5 a.m., 3 p.m., anytime.
How do you spell the name of that company?
In the Port of Oakland.
What's the name? How do you spell that?
Zim, Z-I-M.
Z-I-M.
Yes.
That's the company we're talking
yes.
about. All right, just want to be clear about that. You're going to be coming back a little bit later to talk in some depth about the boycott divestment movement, how it's operating here in the Bay Area and in the country and around the world. So we're looking forward to that. First, of course, it's incredibly important to go to the heart of the matter, which is Gaza. Before we do that, though, there was somebody, a whole bunch of people down there at 5 o'clock ready to act. And Sarah Blanco, who's an apprentice here at KPFA, was down there and met up with a very interesting person. Let's listen to this.
Hello, my name is Sarah Blanco, and I'm with KPFA here in Berkeley. Please tell us your name and where you're from and the reason that you're here, please.
My name is Salwa Sharif, and I am from San Francisco. I am Brazilian-Palestinian, and I am here today to give support to blockade the ship that is coming from Israel. And I think enough is enough. I have family in Gaza. 2 weeks ago, I lost 7 members of my family.
I'm sorry.
And I still have some that they are still alive, but we never know till when. It's not only about Gaza. It is about freedom. It is about justice. I don't know what's going on with the world. Everything is going wrong. And people still say that it's self-defense. What kind of self-defense to kill kids? So they are terrorists? I don't think so that our kids are terrorists. They always use excuses Hamas. They use excuses of the rockets. The rockets never did the same that they do, that they are doing. They support the USA killing people, civilians. It is an offensive to say that it's a war. It is not a war. It is a genocide. And I ask to Americans, wake up, Americans. It is not a war. It is a genocide.
Thank you, first of all. And I am very sorry for your loss. And I know that you're out here very early in the morning. What are you going to do for the rest of the day? I know that you're draped in the Palestinian flag. You look absolutely beautiful today. What are you going to do for the rest of the hours?
I will stay with my friends till the ship comes. And we stand. We will stand for Palestine. We stand for freedom. We stand for justice.
Thank you very much.
We'll
see you later in this afternoon.
Thank you. See you later. Thank you.
And thank you, Sarah Blanco, an apprentice here at KPFA, for that beautiful interview with somebody who was out there at 5 o'clock in the morning. Obviously, Palestinians around the world are affected every time Israel carries out another one of these kinds of massive slaughters, and we seem to see them every 2 years. And talking about that slaughter here with us at the table is Iyad. He's a local Palestinian activist, very engaged, very articulate about all this. And Iyad, we're going to now go to the Gaza Strip, where we're joined by Dr. Mona Alfar. Now, we all are mourning with her the loss of 9 members. Try and imagine the loss of 9 members of your family. Well, that is what Dr. Mona, who works with the Red Crescent and the Middle East Children's Alliance, has had to go through as she tried to help and do the work that she does to save lives in Gaza. Dr. Mona, are you with us? Hi, Dr. Mona. Are you there? She's not on yet. Okay, we're gonna get her in one moment. Let me just ask you to respond from the gut about what we just saw happening in the Gaza Strip.
You know, the reason it's really important to be out there at 3 o'clock today is to block commerce as usual coming from the State of Israel. The Zim line is quite emblematic of what it represents for the Palestinian people, an ongoing campaign of genocide and displacement and occupation. The Zim line, in particular, with the support of the Jewish Agency, was responsible for bringing weapons and Zionist colonizers to Palestine during the foundation of the State of Israel. So the Zim line took part in the Nakba of the Palestinian people. And the Zim line was brought here to San Francisco by Dianne Feinstein in response to increasing commerce with the State of Israel after her visit to the Soviet Union at that time when she was mayor. So we want to send a very clear message that apartheid and business as usual with an apartheid state is not welcomed here. And it is for that reason, as Reem said, that we want everybody to be out there at 3 o'clock. We were able to stall the ship for a whole shift. In fact, they stayed out. They could have been here last night at 10:30, sometime between 10:30 p.m. and midnight. And they stayed off the coast of California all night. And we want to keep them out there because we don't want to do business with such a criminal enterprise.
And they're already losing money based on this action. We do have Dr. Mona Alfada, and also in studio with us is Dr. Mamel Elkada, and she's going to join the dialogue. She has family in Gaza and has a lot to say about this. Well, Dr. Mona, are you with us?
Yes, I am with you. Hello. Hello, friends, brothers, sisters, comrades in the Bay Area. Congratulations that the ship has been turned back, and I hope that you'll succeed to not to allow it to come to the port. I'm talking right now from Gaza, and Israel should pay a price for all the war crimes that has been conducted against civilians, women, children, and men of Gaza Strip. And your act as part of the BDS movement is this is the way that we can let Israel pay a price for what has been done to my people in Gaza, where we're under heavy, savage, unnecessary excessive use of power against our civilians for continuous 33 days, and I'm very positive, and it is not just wishful thinking. I'm very positive that with the BDS movement growing, we will manage to finish with this apartheid regime and end the occupation, like what happened in South Africa. Again, brothers, sisters, comrades, everybody in the Bay Area now, I feel very good about your act this morning or this afternoon. I'm not sure about the time at your place. You cannot imagine the suffering of us here in Gaza when the bombs did not stop dropping over our heads day and night, where our children were terrorized, and not only emotionally terrorized, actually physically killed, where 465 children were killed during this attack, and around 2,000 people were killed, and thousands were injured, and we don't have electricity, we don't have enough water at the moment, and we still need a lot of time to recover out of this very savage attack. So again, BDS movement should continue, and your work gives my people hope in the future that the occupation will end one day.
Dr. Mona, as you told us many times in many different interviews, this suffering that happens when Israel carries out this kind of slaughter affects everybody in Gaza. On this round, it had a extraordinarily terrible impact on you and your family, and of course we all mourn with you, but I would like to ask you to just talk a little bit about what happened to your family, which happened to so many other families as well in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, first I would like to say that what happened to my family happened to tens, hundreds of families in Gaza Strip, but at that night, at that Friday morning, my second cousin and his family were forced to leave their home, and with one missile that hit their home, then the whole family ran into the street, and then another missile hit my cousin in the street, and he was holding his grand child. The grandfather, who is my second cousin, was bleeding because it hit him in the carotid artery. So he was bleeding while holding his two grandchildren, who were bleeding as well, while his wife was helpless and watching in front of her eyes her husband and her grandchildren dying because there was no way that they can make it. It was a very severe attack. Nine persons at that Friday morning lost their lives from my family, including was pregnant. But as I have said earlier, they are not different from many families, but when it hits you directly, it keeps the effect for the rest of your life, especially that there was that they could be saved because of the intensity of the shelling. And this happened everywhere, actually, in Gaza, at very different occasions. Some of our injured have had mild injuries. They bled. They could have been saved. But the ambulance rescue teams were not allowed to reach the injured, and that contributed to the large number of people who were killed. So again, Israel is violating human rights, frankly, openly. And I'm sorry to say that Israel uses tax money that should be American people tax money that should be invested in education, in health, in prosperity, social benefits of the people of America, rather than attacking another people like what's happening in Gaza at the moment.
All right, Dr. Mona, give us a sense of the basic struggles that are happening now. People don't have clean water. They don't have enough food. There's virtually no supplies to begin to rebuild the massive destruction that we saw. Can you just give us a sense of that struggle, please?
Yeah. Actually, 4 days ago, the attacks has stopped because of the ceasefire, and I have visited some of the neighborhoods, like Shajaiya neighborhood and Khvea village. The whole village, for example, in the south was totally destroyed, and Shajaiya neighborhood, as you have said, it is massive destruction. Of course, it happened. So many people became displaced or homeless. They are staying at the schools at the moment, and many electricity lines have been destroyed. That's the reason we don't have electricity till now. The water is not clean. We don't have enough water, not enough food, because those people were living in good neighborhoods and they are now homeless. And that's why we keep receiving increasing number of patients in our medical facilities who are suffering from infectious diseases like diarrhea, gastroenteritis, skin diseases, all those diseases that are linked to bad sanitary conditions. That's why Middle East Children's Alliance, the first thing we started sending money to the Red Crescent Society and the Al Auda Hospital to buy medications, which was life saving when it arrived at its right time. And we started by distributing hygienic kits for families to try to keep some sort of hygiene amongst all this awkward conditions. That's why I take this chance to thank American people, to thank every person who donated even with $1, because even $1 or $2 made a difference for my people during this very difficult time. The next step will be even more difficult because we will be faced with the increasing number of women and children who are suffering of psychological effects, the trauma, the side effects of the trauma. Actually, every child, every person of us at the moment, we don't need normal life. We are strong. We try to be strong, but deep down, the savage attack was as well too strong and unusual. We will continue with your help, with your solidarity as well, like this act is happening, what's happening now at the Bay Area. We like solidarity stand. We like to have guarantees from the world that the siege will be lifted and this attack will not happen again. And the occupation, we are looking for the end of the occupation. We are looking for living in a situation where we have equal rights, sharing the same land or two-state solution. I prefer to have one-state solution based on all of us living in peace, based on equal rights next to each other. This is my vision for the future. Another word, Israel with those savage attacks will never ever secure or guarantee security for its people by attacking another people. What will secure this are achieving rights for Palestinian people.
Dr. Manan, this is Zayad, talking to you from Berkeley in the Bay Area. For the listeners of KPFA and for our community here, they are bombarded on a daily basis by the corporate media carrying the Israeli talking points, saying that Israel is defending itself. Israel needs to act criminally sometimes, and although it's unpleasant, the murder of children is somehow important for the continuity of Israeli security. I think it would be very helpful if you talk a little bit about the details of Khuza'a, the summary executions that were taking place over there, because people cannot really envision, they did not see the footage coming out of Khuza'a. So if you could just describe that to the public here, that would be very helpful.
What happened in Khuza'a village, especially in Khuza'a village, that they hit one area, so the people, ordinary people, I'm not talking about armed men, I'm talking about civilians, ordinary people. So they hit one house or one neighborhood in the village. The people moved to another place for safety. They kept hitting other places, and that's what happened in Khuza'a. People kept moving from one place to another until most of the village was wiped out, and there was no journalist allowed to enter the village. There was complete, it was announced as military area. And after that, when journalists was allowed to enter the area, the smell of this was everywhere, because more than 200 were killed in Khuza'a village. I'm not sure of the number exactly, but hundreds were killed. Because when I visited the village personally a few days later, the smell of this was very strong. And during my visit, there was some teams trying to rescue some bodies outside of the rubble. And in the end, the whole village left to Khan Yunis in the west. And it is not only houses that have been destroyed. The agricultural land has been completely destroyed. Trees uprooted. A large, extensive sabotage happened there. This is Khuza'a, but this happened in other areas as well. In the middle of Gaza Strip, thousands of trees have been uprooted, homes demolished, and again, this is in the middle. Then when you go to the north, the same practices again. There was great destruction, great destroyment, and you have said something about Israel defending its security. According to the international law, when Israel hit schools and they claim that there are armed men next to the schools, they are not allowed to hit the school even if the armed men were inside the school. This is the international law and the Geneva Convention about the protection of civilians during the war. What Israel did during this attack, they are creating very good grounds for more hatred and feeling of revenge. Of course, we will work and keep working for peace, but it will be very difficult. When you ask a child to draw a nice photo, they have experienced war and drooping and grief and loss. So they start drawing what they have experienced. We keep all our forces.
Dr. Mona, we're losing our connection with you. I really want to thank you for joining us and for all the important information that you bring us.
I think
we're losing you. But we're going to call you back for another segment in this show in about an hour. We appreciate you taking the time and the incredible work you do with Mecca and with all the folks in Gaza to try and mitigate some of the unbelievable suffering that is wrought upon the Gaza Strip by the occupiers in Israel. You're listening to a special broadcast of KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, and KFCF in Fresno of the Block the Boat movement. We're going to take a short musical break, and we're going to come back. We've got a doctor here who's got family in the Gaza Strip, who's here in the Bay Area. We're going to hear from her. We just wanted to give you a slight musical break and let the engineers put a few things together. Stay with us.
Zionists are evil, even the rabbis know the Zionists are crazy. We take life for granted, but they're killing newborn babies. Freedom won't be changed until they feel the same pain. Palestinians shower tears pouring down like rain. Every word is a fact, not one was an opinion. When I say free Palestine, I'm talking pavilions. Free Palestine, and lay down your weapons. This is for the innocent souls that went to heaven. Cause what happened in America on 9/11 happens in Palestine 24/7. Sing it. Free, free Palestine, 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 free, free Palestine. Israel is funded by many, including Obama. Then to say that the bigger threats came from Osama, that's not true. Most of that stuff is lies. They don't show how hundreds died overnight. Can you imagine if that was one of us? Houses, families all blown down to dust. Many being kidnapped and virgins being raped. Many have been injured but none receive any aid. Is taking a life really worth it for just some land? Those who drink from Starbucks surely don't understand. More Israeli goods being sold means more weapons. More bullets that kill Palestinians every second. Freedom won't be achieved until they feel the same pain. Palestinians shower tears pouring down like rain. Every word is a fact, not one was an opinion. When I say free Palestine, I'm talking for billions. Free Palestine, and lay down your weapons. This is for the innocent souls that went to heaven. Cause what happened in America on 9/11 happens in Palestine 24/7. Sing it. Free, free Palestine, 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 free, free Palestine.
Is the Tall Man Happy? That's the name of a dazzling new film by Michel Gondry. The film is an animated conversation with Noam Chomsky. Is the Tall Man Happy? Will show at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland on Wednesday, September 17th at 7 p.m. in a benefit for the Middle East Children's Alliance, and it's wheelchair accessible. Riveting, intimate, and exuberant, this conversation between the filmmaker and Noam Chomsky is a movie that celebrates the life of a great mind and makes a case for the mind that knows less but keeps on asking. Is the Tall Man Happy at the Grand Lake Theater, 3200 Grand Avenue in Oakland, September 17th. For info, meccaforpeace.org, 510-548-0542.
We are back. You are listening to a special here at KPFA in Berkeley, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and there are a whole bunch of people who came out this morning to be a part of Block the Boat. This has to do with Israel, the boycott of Israel, and the most, among other things, the most recent slaughter that the occupiers carried out in the Gaza Strip. And we're going to talk just a little bit more about the medical side of this with Dr. Manal El-Khada. She is a physician here in the Bay Area with family in the Gaza Strip. Welcome. It took a bit to get you on. Sorry for mispronouncing your name.
Thank you.
But it's good
me.
To have you with us. Lean right into the microphone and tell us what it's like to be a physician here, where you're charged with healing people and making people better and seeing your people being slaughtered in the Gaza Strip.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on your show. It was actually a very traumatic experience for someone like myself who is used to helping people to feel better. So what happened initially is, like many other Palestinians here and abroad, we turned to Al Jazeera, other news, you know, Arabic language news, to see what's happening instantaneously at the hour, every hour, with live feed coverage. So the first few days, we saw that it was mostly an air attack, and then it was by sea. And then really the worry started when we heard of the ground invasion. The areas where my families are from now, many of your listeners are probably familiar with, Beni Suhaila, which is next to next to Khan Yunis, Abasan, and Khuza'a, Zanna, Garara. These are all of these towns are in the governorate of Khan Yunis, and that's where my family is from. So the first thing that affected my family was the ground invasion. So the tanks actually were almost, you know, coming down. They could see the tanks. This is other than the continuous fire by air, land, and sea that was already happening. You have to remember, I'd like to paint a picture if we can step back. For many in that region, this was a special time of year. It's Ramadan. You can think of it like Christmas for 30 days. It's a time of gifts, a time of family. So people would, you know, this is a time where people gather around to be with each other. And so this is when Israel chose to start this assault. So if you can imagine, people are fasting, it's summer, it's hot, they're out of school, kids are playing. You know, it's still a cheerful place, even with what we hear about Gaza. And so to go back to my family story, the tank fire started, the artillery hit their home in the garden outside of the home. And so that was the first of my family to start fleeing. So they fled on foot with, you know, very large families. You can imagine many children. They fled to Beni Suhaila. After that, some of the surrounding villages also started getting hit. So people would just kind of center in one area and would just leave their homes, either due to, again, destruction of a home nearby or an open area. So they were also targeting open areas so that people would get scared and just leave. And so they came to other city centers. And then while they were trying to seek shelter somewhere else, then the new area where they would go to would also get attacked. And so then the second part was, there was a nearby mosque. Again, people inside praying, children outside, you know, praying inside, people playing outside. There was a hit there, and then unfortunately that killed some extended members of the family, an 8-year-old boy that was playing outside, you know, elderly who were praying inside the mosque. And so after that happened, people got very scared, as you can imagine. And then it was the Abu Jama family massacre that many have heard about here in San Francisco and in the United States, because it actually made it on the news. So what happened was, 3-4 generations of one family were in a home, sitting down, around dinner time, ready to break their fast, and an Israeli airstrike hit their home, killing 4 pregnant women, 18 children, and a few men sitting around. And you can imagine being that person's neighbor and hearing about this happening. And so, again, people started fleeing more. And I think the one thing that my family said was, this war felt different. We felt that they were becoming innovative of ways to instill fear in us, because we always seek shelter with our family. We always feel safe with our family. And when they would kill 4 generations of one family in a targeted airstrike, you can imagine for young children and women and the collective, you know, unit, how difficult it would be to feel safe anywhere. And I think that was unfortunate that that was purpose. That's a, you know, purposeful act. We're talking about, of course, as you all know, one of the strongest military powers in the world. If they have a target that's a moving vehicle, they can, you know, they can aim at that and get that target. So to say that all these innocent people who were killed in their homes, in schools, in places of worship, were an accident, or we don't mean to kill civilians, as these, you know, these lines that we keep hearing from the Israeli spokespeople, I think it's time for everyone to question that kind of statement. So to continue, that was one example, and it, unfortunately, it didn't end there, because the more that people would move away to other somebody else's house, the closer the fighting would get. Because again, we have to remember, this is nonstop, aerial bombardment. It didn't really stop. So after that, when Abu Jama family got killed, many people did not feel safe in that area, and so started leaving to Khan Yunis, which is the neighboring city. One of them being my aunt. So my aunt, they lived in an area called Zanna, which is in an area that was starting to become a military area. So what that means is they would clear, once they would be at the border, you know, of a certain neighborhood in Gaza, they were trying to advance militarily with the tanks on the ground. And so they would start bombarding everything in front of them, put the tanks on the ground, and literally try to clear the area. And so, unfortunately, her house and some of my other family's houses were closer to that area. And so they've all lost their homes. And you can imagine losing your home. We cannot imagine, because none of us have gone through that. But to think of, you know, this is a house where I spent many summers in, have great memories in, and hearing her on the phone crying to me because she didn't take a picture of her children with her. That was her concern. Sure. And her certificates of her, you know, children's, you know, like the star of the week type thing. That's all she was crying to me about. And, you know, I told her, the important thing is you're alive, you're all safe. And just if I can have a few minutes to talk about their story.
Please, but
okay?
Just to point out that this is really a part of the dehumanization process, mm-hmm. to take people's family histories mm-hmm. away. Mm-hmm. You know, you kill the family and the history, wipe it back and forward several generations. This fits into what we often call ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. That's what it means. That's what genocide means. But go on.
Yeah, so I'll give the example of my aunt that I'm speaking about right now. So they had fled to one person, you know, her daughter's house, and then her, which is my cousin. And then they, unfortunately, airstrike on her in-law's house, killing both of her brother-in-laws. And so, again, they fled. And then they ended up just fleeing to Khan Yunis, which is seen as kind of a little far, again, because we don't have family there. So people were just going to the UN schools. I mean, the picture that they drew when we would speak to them, people were literally in the street because they didn't know where to go. People didn't feel safe anywhere. The schools, the United Nations schools that were in Khan Yunis were mostly filled. People who had gone earlier were able to rent an apartment. Some people were staying with, you know, family, friends, coworkers, anybody they could find. And unfortunately, even when they were in Khan Yunis, there was an airstrike at the building next door. And the shrapnel unfortunately affected, you know, the people who are staying in the surrounding area. And she told me at that instant, some of the children were bloodied. You know, some of the people had actual physical injury. She said, we grabbed everybody, and it was at nighttime. With no shoes on, we literally ran barefoot back to Beni Suhaila. And you can imagine, you know, actually hearing these stories from a family member. I mean, it was, you know, it was very traumatic, and I really tried my best to just share these stories, you know, with my friends, with my coworkers, or with, you know, people in general, because the unfortunate thing about what's happening is this is not the first time, and it keeps repeating itself. And especially when it comes to this time, though, I do think things are a little different. I think that the dehumanizing discourse regarding Palestinian people in generally, I feel for the first time it's changing, because people are coming up to us and saying, why are they killing these innocent children? And that's the one thing that our families there, like Dr. Muna Al-Farra said, this is not just my story. Everyone there has a story. Everybody there has a story. I think, actually, I remembered one other thing that happened to our extended family. So that was my aunt. I spoke to some of my cousins yesterday. You know, they're happy that there's no, you know, air fire right now, but nobody knows if it's going to start again. So
everybody lives in constant fear of the next bombardment.
And that's a part of it. Yeah. That's a part of it, to have this constant fear. Now, on the right before they called the first ceasefire, again, I had other family members who lived closer to the agricultural areas. And some of them fled. Some of them decided to stay. And then one of their uncles was killed in an attack in the home. And so they all fled. They fled closer to, again, another central part of the town. And the Israeli airships, they dropped, you know, they fired a missile in a more open area. People became very, very afraid. And usually when they do that, they know that they're going to hit somewhere close by. And so they were scared that they were going to hit the houses that they were in, because they know when they do that, then the three generations of the family end up being killed. And so they ran outside because of the fear. And then another Israeli strike came, and that killed my cousin's children. And this was on the last day.
In the street.
Yeah,
they
and
hit the
actually,
house and then hit them in the street.
It killed six people. Two of them were children. The youngest was 7 years old. And, you know, it was, I mean, it's very sad. But like Doctor said, this is the story of every single person in Gaza has a family member or a friend, a relative, a neighbor who's been, you know, killed. I think the one thing that my family was saying that this time it's a little different is the level of destruction. They have not seen this kind of destruction before, because again, it wasn't just the houses; it was the agricultural lands, the places of worship, the schools, the factories, the electrical lines, the water well. Every single water well has been, you know, almost every water well has been attacked. And so you can imagine people right now, even though they have survived, those who have survived the actual, you know, military onslaught, are now fighting something far different. Everybody is actually sick. All our family members mostly are sick right now with viral gastroenteritis, like she mentioned, you know, dysentery. There is no water and no electricity. I don't think people understand that. There's no water and no electricity right now.
Yeah.
It is unbelievable.
The things I'm hearing from my family on the ground in Gaza is that this is far worse. That I think that in the aftermath of this massacre and the destruction, whole generations have been wiped off the map. Whole towns, whole villages. This is as bad as the Nakba.
This is genocide.
This is genocide, right?
And this is why this is the word that people are using rightfully.
But I think despite that, I think that there is a resilience that people on the ground, my family is saying, we would rather die standing on our feet than the slow death that we're going to be facing in the next 10 years. So I think something has shifted.
All right, we're going to talk about this. Yeah. We're going to talk about the fight back. Mm-hmm. Doctor, appreciate you joining us. It is terrifying to hear about your loss, and obviously unimaginable what it is like on the ground to have your house get one of those little knock bombs, go outside and not know which way to run, too many children now talk about, you know, ask what they want to do when they grow up, and they say, we're not going to grow up because we're going to have, you know, a next war and a next war and a next war, but there is a battle going on. Again, thank you.
We're going to continue
the discussion. You're listening to a special on KPFA Free Speech Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I'm here with Iyad, and we're going to talk with you, Iyad, and then we're going to talk with Reem. First, though, it's really important to just give some background. Set this up. How did we get where we are, and what does this look like in that context of history?
I think for many of us, people have become somewhat desensitized to the human story that Palestinians tell. What is important to appreciate here, that the Abu Jama'a family that Manal talked about, not only that they lose 27 members in a single strike, but part of the family moved into a UN school, the survivors, and that school was hit and they lost parts of the family. And then when they were taken out of the UN school as injured, they were taken to a hospital, and members of that family also got killed in that hospital. So this is truly an extermination campaign for that family, for the experience of that family. But what's important to realize is that Gaza is a refugee population. It's made of 1.8 million people, 1.5 million of which are refugees that were displaced during the 1948 occupation of Palestine, what we call the Great Catastrophe, the Nakba, the establishment of the colonial state of Israel. Out of those 1.5 million people, today, one-third of them are rendered homeless by this attack. For the last 7 years, those 1.8 million people have been living in an open-air prison. And the Israeli strategy has been to block medicine, block food, block basic supplies, block the progress of life, stop fishermen from exercising their ability to fish and bring food to the table, shoot at fishermen, shoot at farmers, destroy farmland with tanks and uproot trees. So the pressure on Gaza for the past 7 years has been also pressure of extermination. So when you look at the situation and you ask people, what would you prefer? And they would say, they were killing us slowly and no one was paying attention. And now that they've attacked us and we're fighting back, we actually were able to push them back. So the question really that's being raised here to the American public and the American administration is, why does the United States support such a criminal enterprise? Why is it that they have to exterminate families en masse before the White House comes out and says, oh, we're suspending the hellfire missiles? Imagine, they're called hellfire and they're suspending them only. But the fact of the matter is that billions of dollars flow into Israel on an annual basis. Military aid goes out of the United States on an annual basis. And this is not limited to Gaza. The West Bank, tens of people have been murdered in the West Bank over the past few months. And no one is covering that here in the United States, because the U.S. government policy is to unconditionally support the expansion and the strengthening of the state of Israel as a military base out there in the Middle East, as a military base that executes U.S. policy by any means necessary, even if it meant the extermination of our people. We are the indigenous people of that land. My generation, my family can trace its history for 800 years in Palestine. There are families who can trace their histories even longer than that. And the reason why they are exterminating our people is because they want to have a Jewish-only state that is contrary to the organic fabric of the pluralistic society that has existed there for thousands of years, of Christians and Jews and Muslims and atheists and all kinds of religions living in pluralistic societies. But the establishment of the state of Israel was to create a Zionist state that said, if you are a person who does not identify as a Jewish ethnic person, then you are either a second-class citizen, or you are occupied, or you need to be kicked out. What is really important to realize here, Dennis, is that Israel has shown the world over the course of 67 years, in spite of independence, in spite of being one of the strongest military in the world, that it's not about security, that Israel is incapable of coexisting with the indigenous people of Palestine. Israel has established an apartheid system within the 1948 boundaries, within the green zone, what they call the two-state solution. There's Israel and the West Bank and Gaza. Within that green zone, one-fifth of the population is Palestinian. And that one-fifth of the population is treated very poorly. Israel managed to kill over 2 million Palestinians over the course of 67 years. Israel managed to displace a total of 7.1 million refugees out of Palestine. It's not the 700,000 that people talk about on the day of the Nakba. But over the course of history, 7.1 million Palestinians are refugees. I and Manal and others are refugees, but also the people of Gaza, 1.5 million of them are refugees. The people of the West Bank, there are many refugees over there. And they chase them and they exterminate them in their refugee camps, in Khuza'a, in Shaja'iyya, elsewhere. And there are the people who were pushed outside of the boundaries of Palestine, who are also under attack. And they're under attack by a systematic campaign of pacification. The reason why Israel conducts its actions the way it does, as Manal said, it wants to instill fear in the Palestinian people so that the Palestinian people give up resistance. They go into the West Bank and they kidnap children as young as 4 and 5 and 6 years old in the middle of the night. They take them to jail. They beat them up. They ask them to report on their families, on their neighbors. And even if they had no information, that very experience makes them feel that Israel is bigger than life. That if you ever think of resisting the state of Israel, you and your family are going to be exterminated, your home is going to be demolished, you will not carry on as an individual, as a family, your lineage is going to be cut off. That, as you said, is the definition of ethnic cleansing.
All right, the voice of Iyad, very eloquent presentation of the situation in terms of the ongoing, I never know whether to say genocide or attempted genocide because the people are fighting back, but in terms of international law, one does not have to wipe out an entire peoples to call it a genocide, and people get confused about that. But this is clearly, if I've ever seen a nation attempting to wipe out another nation in my life, this is it.
The Convention on Genocide, just to be clear on this,
yes.
I'm not a lawyer, but we as Palestinians have to read up on this stuff. But the Convention on Genocide defines the destruction of a people in part or in full. And the destruction of the people extends to the destruction of their infrastructure, the transfer of a population, and the lack of a protection by an occupying power. What Israel is doing today, with U.S. money, with the complicity of the Obama administration, I want to be very clear here. Barack Obama is complicit in this war crime. Barack Obama gave coverage to this war crime. John Kerry is complicit in this war crime. They are providing coverage. They are providing cover for Israel to continue its extermination campaign against our people with U.S. tax money. And it is for that reason that we are out there in Oakland today stopping commerce as usual from the Zimliner, from the criminal ship coming from the apartheid state of Israel to conduct business with the United States.
And that, Iyad, is a perfect segue for where we're going to go. Now we're going to take a short musical break. I want to let people know that you are listening to KPFA in Berkeley. You know it. KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno. This is a special, it's a special block, the boat. The boat has been blocked temporarily. We're going to get into that. But I want to let you know we have a lot more coming up for you. So please stay tuned. We're going to take just some music and be right back.
This ain't living. Was getting bomb, Obama didn't say this.
O-B-A-M-A, you ain't fooling everyone, I see the games you play. You was VIP at the BIC, and we know that's the code name for CIA. The same way your cameras are watching us, we're watching you. Think we're easy to control, you ain't got a clue. Revolution's on the way, let's see what you're gonna do. You're gonna send the troops, you're gonna drop the news. See, it's not
it was getting bomb, Obama didn't say shit.
Was the bigger threat from Osama or from Obama? Military bases from Chagos to Okinawa. I say things that other rappers won't say, cause my mind never closed like Guantanamo Bay. Hope you didn't feel the statue attack to your arm, cause the drones are still flying over Pashtunistan. Did he defend the war?
No.
He extended more, even had the time to attempt to ruin Ecuador. Morales and Chavez, the states are on a hunt for ya. Military now stationed on bases in Colombia. Take a trip to the past and tell them I was right. Ask Ali Abu Nima and Jeremiah Wright. Drones over Pakistan, Yemen and Libya. Is Obama the bomber getting ready for Syria? First black president, the masses were hungry, but the same president just bombed an African country like... The strip was getting bomb, Obama didn't say this.
And we are back, and you're listening to KPFA Free Speech Radio. This is a Block the Boat special. The boat has been temporarily blocked. We're going to hear a lot more about that, and we've got several guests. Let's take them one at a time. Back joining us is Reem Asil. She is a key organizer with the Block the Boat movement. Well, why don't you bring people up to speed in case people are just tuning in? People were supposed to go out at 5 o'clock in the morning, but something happened. Give us a complete update, please, and lean right into the mic.
Great. So for folks who are just tuning in, as a result of the amazing organizing happening with over 70 progressive organizations and their organizing efforts in the Bay, we were able to delay one of the most prominent shipping companies from the state of Israel from docking its boat at the Port of Oakland, which it does every Saturday to conduct its business, and this is a direct this is a testament of the organizing that has happened over the last few weeks, as we've sent a clear message both to the international community, to the state of Israel, to this company called the Zim Shipping Lines, that you we will no longer stand silent or idle as you continue to conduct business at our ports. We are saying no to Zionism in Oakland or to any West Coast port, and so we are asking folks to come out at 3 o'clock p.m. We want to make it clear that
so you moved it to 3.
We moved it to 3.
The same spot, or
so the ship is out there idling in the shores of California,
costing them money
by the minute as they sit there. They're trying to wait us out. We need to send a message that we are steadfast in our struggle with the Palestinian people. The eyes of the international community are on us and are looking to the leadership of people in Oakland. So it's really important that everybody turns out at 3 o'clock p.m. today at the West Oakland BART. We will march en masse to the Port of Oakland and send our message loud and clear.
All right. And now let me ask you, and then we're also going to bring in Lara Kashawi. But let me ask you to just explain what the movement is, what the boycott divestment movement is.
Sure. More particular to this port, this port shut down. This is not the first time that we have shut down the Port of Oakland from blocking an Israeli enterprise from coming in. In 2010, we held a successful boycott from preventing Israeli goods from coming in. And this is part of the larger, ever-growing movement of boycott, divestment, and sanctions to really isolate the state of Israel and all the business that it does, and particularly its ties to the U.S. and the role that we play in helping facilitate the war crimes that Israel conducts on a daily basis for the last 67 years. And that means boycotting any goods that come from Israel, whether it means divesting our monies within cities, within our universities, that go to fueling the Israeli occupation through companies, atrocious companies like General Electric, Boeing, Caterpillar, that supply Israeli military tools and weapons to suppress the Palestinian people and to kill the Palestinian people, or whether it means putting pressure on our governments from the local to the federal level to impose sanctions and to isolate Israel. Right now, we support Israel to the tune of $3.1 billion of our tax money. And so this is part of an ever-growing movement to isolate the Zionist enterprise, this project of Israel. This was a direct call from Palestinian civil society, including the Federation of Trade Unions in Palestine, that made a call out to workers in the international community to stop handling Israeli goods. And so we're joining this movement of solidarity all over the world. We have ports all over the West Coast, all the way up from Vancouver down to Long Beach. We have solidarity actions in Liverpool, in South Africa, from the shores of Miami to New York. So the whole world is joining and sending a message that we will be steadfast in making sure that the project of Israel will be isolated. We will no longer do business as usual, and we will put pressure on our government to impose sanctions on the state of Israel.
Lara, let me bring you into this. Tell us a little bit about what the Arab Resource Organizing Center is doing in this context. I know that one of the things you've been doing is just sort of helping the community recover from one loss, one attack, one death, one killing after another. But tell us a little bit more about the work and why this particular movement and today's action is important. Please lean into the mic.
You know, one of the main things that we've been doing, as you said, recovering from the loss and the impact of the trauma happening and devastation in Palestine, but a part of that also includes empowering our community, right, and involving them in the resistance, the international global efforts to support the Palestinian resistance on the ground, and as Palestinians here in the United States to be part of that struggle. And we do that by organizing ourselves. Palestinians and Arab, young, old, community, families, they have been the ones leading the effort in the recent organizing in the Bay Area, with thousands of people taking and flooding the streets of San Francisco to show that we are standing in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Palestine, that we are one unified people, that we are not going to be divided, we are not going to be fragmented, we are not going to be isolated or criminalized. You know, one of the biggest issues we face here in the United States is the criminalization of Palestinian activism. Palestine is an exceptional issue here because of the relationship between the United States and this, in the apartheid state of Israel. And as a result, we have cases such as Rasmiya Elde in Chicago, an elderly Palestinian woman, a former political prisoner, who's been criminalized here and is now being charged with immigration fraud and deportation after all the years of organizing she's done. These are issues that we try to highlight and raise, and by empowering our young people to take to the streets and organize demonstrations, by empowering our community to go to the port and block the boat, by empowering our, you know, our families to really raise awareness about what's going on in Palestine, we are in fact challenging the criminalization of Palestinian activism. We are challenging the attempt to suppress resistance and the state of repression that the United States and Israel both share globally. So this is part of the work of BDS. BDS is not only about involving allies in isolating the Zionist colonial project. BDS is also about involving everybody all over the world in a form of resistance that lifts up the resistance on the ground in Palestine, that sends a clear message that we will not stand for apartheid Israel, that we will not stand for racism, we will not stand for any type of colonial project as we did in South African apartheid.
And in terms of organizing, I've been out in the protests and I've been doing a lot of interviewing. And one of the most interesting things is meeting people who have never protested before. And I've met some pretty interesting people, Palestinians who are like, you know, a couple of women, obviously very wealthy. It looked like they had just came from some major ball. And I said, what are you doing out here in the street? And says, well, we've never done anything like this before, but we can't believe what we're seeing and what we're hearing about and what our families are telling us. And we just found out about this protest. We saw some advertisement, some poster, and we want to be here because we want them to stop killing our children. People who are not I mean, they're just out there. More and more people who have never been out before.
What people are seeing is, you know, given social media and even mainstream media's coverage of the recent attacks, you can't hide the atrocities in Palestine. You just simply cannot hide it. And it's outrageous. So everyone, old, young, every type of person, allies, workers, community members, are outraged by what's happening. But our community specifically is outraged. We've been going through this for 67 years. This is not a new attack. Gaza has been under siege for 7 years. While people now woke up to what's happening because of the atrocious, you know, videos and images that are being spread all over the news, ultimately we know this has been happening and we've been dying a slow death for 67 years in Palestine with the ethnic cleansing of our entire indigenous population. And people are outraged. They're outraged and they want to do something. So yes, it's not a surprise that we're seeing people take to the streets. I think what we have to do is seize this moment and really build across different communities and raise awareness about the role of Israel, both here and in Palestine. Because Israel is not only occupying Palestinian people, it's not only criminalizing Palestinian people, Israel is also training local police departments here in the United States. Israel also plays a direct role in the repression of communities of color here. We want to make a very clear message to the world that not only does the United States fund in billions of dollars the apartheid state of Israel, but Israel trains police and law enforcement locally. That's not a coincidence. This is a real issue that we have to be addressing and making connections about the fact that while young black people are being murdered by police that have been trained by the United States, by the United States bringing Israel to train them here, people of color in Palestine, the indigenous population of Palestinian people, have been massacred and murdered by Israel being funded by the United States. These connections we have to be drawing on and building a global movement to isolate Israel not only for Palestinians, but to isolate Israel for the well-being of all people, because ultimately if we bring down the apartheid state, the Zionist state of Israel, we will bring down racism in a very clear form. We're bringing down a direct form of colonialism and weakening the United States' global power internationally.
Now, we're in a particular moment in history with the destruction of humanity, and so we have a choice. Right, we have a choice to fight that or to stand complicit. And the tides are really turning on an international level. People are no longer willing to stay complicit in these crimes.
All right, let me bring into the discussion Monadel Herzala. He's with the Palestinian Community Network National Board. And, well, this is definitely happening. We're here in the Bay Area. We're broadcasting to the Bay Area, many activists from the Bay Area. But this is a national and an international movement. You want to talk a little bit about how that looks? And welcome, by the way.
Thank you.
And tell me the correct way. It's hard to read the writing on this sheet. How do we say your name, please?
Monadel Herzala. Monadel.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sorry about that.
First of all, I wanted to say that I am proud and honored to bring about the voices of workers in Gaza, voices of union organizers, health workers, public sectors workers who have suffered the destruction of their about 95 schools, had students, had workers, close to 40 fishermen boats, that is the livelihood of thousands of families in Gaza. These people, these brothers and sisters, have called upon the labor and unions around the world to stand firmly, to stand strongly against injustice that is taking place against the families and the working families of Gaza. We are very confident that people who have history in standing up, like the union workers around the port, around the world, who stood firmly and stood high and say, we are not going to load or unload ships from South Africa. We're not going to load and unload ships from fascist Italy in the 30s. They are continuing this tradition. This call means to us, as I was listening to Dr. Manal, who were among our community members, marching with her family years ago. Now she's talking about her experience and our family and my family in Gaza, and talking about how when we talk to them personally, they say we are tired of being looked at as a headless people, as people they look at children being killed And now it's time, and I'm asserting of what Lara has mentioned earlier, what Reem has mentioned earlier, the fact that we need to hold whoever responsible for this. There is no longer Palestinians feel that they need sympathy or support from each other. From other. We want, this is a human fight for justice. We need them to, we need to cause damage to the oppressor. We need to hold Israel responsible. And as we speak, U.S. Palestinian Community Network, as we speak and as we mobilizing for the 3 p.m. gathering in the port of Oakland, our brothers and sisters in Chicago are protesting the Boeing of that is the strongest or the richest manufacturer of arms, of the F-16 and F-17 that is shelling and bombing Gaza. We are protesting this company. We're protesting whoever is standing with it as much as we're protesting Zim's ship and Israel government. There is, they cannot be business as usual for Israel and for gaining profits as much as there is no normal life for the children of Gaza.
It's interesting. You, and we're going to, by the way, we're going to ask you to stay with us because we're going to talk more about the workers and the role of the workers and the unions in this battle here. But you mentioned the workers of the Gaza Strip, and people don't, and you talked about the fishermen. And, you know, the incredible... People don't talk about the fact that Gaza has some of the most beautiful beaches in the world. And that's an important part of, it used to be an important part of people's lives. The sea, swimming in the sea, playing in the sea, fishing in the sea, finding your livelihood in the sea. And people don't realize that this attack, you know, it got some attention when the Israelis shelled offshore and killed a bunch of kids who were playing soccer or football, whatever you want to call it, on the beach. But this suffering that Israel extracts from the sea is dramatic, and it undermines the life in Gaza in a whole other way.
I'm glad you asked me this, Dennis. It's each and every aspect of life has been affected. People use the beach to go have picnics. They have they fish for their livelihood. The blockade and the siege of Gaza that's lasted for the last 7 years, this is not the first attack actually that affected and have children as victims. The young girl in 2009 were attacked while they're having a picnic, and there is a clip of her calling her father as she witnessing him dying on the beach. The fishermen of Gaza has been limited to very few kilometers. Instead of having like 10-15 kilometers, they only have 5 kilometers to fish, which is limiting their livelihood as a result of the blockade, as a result of the siege that's going on for the last 7 years. And I need to stress on the fact that oppressed people do not have short memory. The fact that people and the population in Gaza is a result of refugees of the 1948. It's the highly populated area in the whole world. When they are attacking any square mile of Gaza, they know for a fact that they are going to cause damages and cause a lot of civilians dead. So on most of the 90% of the infrastructure of Gaza has been destroyed. According to the union leaders in Gaza and the PG, if you just Palestinian Federation of Workers in Palestine, they have suffered 15,000 ton of explosive in Gaza in the last few days of that.
It's amazing. All right, Monitel, I'm going to ask you to stay by because we're going to keep talking about workers.
Yes.
And unions and this and the relationship to the workers. Obviously, it's the workers who have to decide or not decide to unload these ships. Some have cooperated, and that battle continues. We're going to take a short musical break. We're going to be joined by Clarence Thomas, a longtime Bay Area union activist, almost a legend here in the Bay Area, and Steve Zeltzer, who does labor programming here at KPFA and who's is helping us to live stream this to you. I don't know what the names are. Forgive me. We're doing 3 hours here. All right. Anyway, stay with us. And we're also going to invite some of the apprentices who have been working very hard on this to sort of take over the show. So stand by for that as well. We'll be right back.
فضلوا شر يكون شو بتحب مضيف دم عربي ولا دموع من عيوننا بعتقد هيك تأملوا نستقبل من هيك تعقدوا لما تدركموا على غلطة من هيك البسنا الكوفي البيضة والسودة صاروا كلاب الزمان يلبسوها كمودة مهما تفننوا فيها مهما غيروا بلونة كوفية عربية بتضل عربية حصتنا بدنا إياه ثقافتنا بدنا إياه كرامتنا بدنا إياه كل شيء إلنا بدنا إياه ما راح نسكت لن نسمح لن ليه بقلن يسرقوا شغلة مش إلهن ما حصن فيه هالدولة بلتبس لبس هالقري كفي هن طمعانين عالقدس قدس عرفوا كيف كونوا بحر جينا نذكرن مين احنا وغصب عن ابوهم هاي حطتنا من هيك لبسنا الكوفي لانه وطني الكوفي كوفي عربي من هيك لبسنا الكوفي هويتنا الاساسيه الكوفي كوفي عربي يلا علم كوفي علولي هالكوفي الكوفي كوفي عربي علو هلا بلاد الشام كوفي عربي مثل العربي ما في بعد مثل الشعب العربي فرجوني اي امي بالدنيا اكثر مؤثره الصوره واضحه نحن مهد الحضاره تاريخنا وتراثنا الشاهد على وجودنا من هيك لبست الثوب الفلسطيني من حفا جنين جبل النار الى رام الله خليني اشوف الكوفيه البيضه والحمرة خلينا نعليها لفوق بالسما انا هداه ديك العرب الثاني بخص غزه الثاني بهز هزكلي ماتي حرب سجل انا شاد يا منصور والحطة هويتي من يوم ما خلقت سيدي والشعب مسؤوليتي لك انا تربيت بين الغرب وبين الشر بين القتين بين بخيل بين حقي شفت الحياة من الشقتين انا مثل الصوفية كيف ما لبستوني وين ما شلحتوني بضلني عاوصولي فلسطينية من هيك لبسنا الكوفي لأننا وطنية الكوفي كوفي عربي من هيك لبسنا الكوفي هويتنا الاساسية الكوفي كوفي عربي يلا علم كوفي علولي هالكوفي الكوفي كوفي عربي علو هلا بلاد الشام كوفي عربي بدل عربي
And we're back. You're listening to Special Block, the boat coverage here on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno. I'm Dennis Bernstein, and well, we're going to focus on the role of the unions, because clearly union workers need to decide to load or unload that ship, whether they're going to participate, whether they're going to join the boycott, and that battle is ongoing. Well, joining us, let me bring you into this, Steve Zeltz, a longtime labor correspondent for KPFA, deeply engaged in the labor movement. Why don't you talk a little, we're going to bring in Clarence Thomas in one moment, but just set this up in terms of the union struggle and what this looks like to you.
The labor movement in the United States, particularly the ILWU, have been played a critical role in opposing apartheid. And after a lot of education and organizing, and Clarence can talk about that, in the ILWU, there was a boycott in 1984 of South African cargo here in the Ned Lloyd in San Francisco. And it turns out that the Zim Line actually at that time was involved in supporting South Africa as an apartheid regime. So there's been an education campaign to make the connection between apartheid South Africa and apartheid Israel. Workers in Israel are second-class citizens if they're not Jewish. And why would we accept support for a regime that discriminates people on the basis of religion or nationality or sex or anything like that. And yet that is what's happened in Israel. So in 2010, there was a picket of about 800 people, and the ILWU members refused to cross at ILWU Local 10 and Local 34. As a result, that was the first labor action in the United States, direct labor action, against the regime in Israel. And actually, the consulate came to ILWU and demanded to speak there, and they rejected the government official from Israel. So there's a lot of pressure, and there was a debate at the San Francisco Labor Council a week and a half ago to support Israel, to oppose it. And they accused those who were supporting the Palestinians as being fascistic and anti-Semitic. And this is at the San Francisco Labor Council. But the fact of the matter is, workers in the United States have a reason to support the Palestinian workers. Equal rights, solidarity, and fighting an apartheid regime that terrorized them and uses U.S. bombs, $3.5 billion, to destroy their cities and their communities.
All right, let's bring in Clarence Thomas to the discussion. Clarence, welcome to Flashpoint. Welcome to this. I'm getting dizzy now, getting old. But welcome. It's good to hear your voice again, Clarence Thomas. Give us your response to this Block the Boat movement. Why are you engaged? Why are you involved? Why are you supporting the workers who have decided to refuse to unload these ships?
Well, first of all, let me say that it's an honor, and I'm proud to be on the line and virtually on the line in terms of this phone call and today at the port with Monado and Laura and the other activists and members of the Palestinian and Arab community. Let me first of all say that I'm speaking today as a rank and filer. As many of you may be aware, the ILWU is involved in a very protracted and difficult contract negotiations with our employers, the Pacific Maritime Association. The rank and file has not had an opportunity to vote on any resolutions with respect to this action today. But having said that, I will be participating. I know that rank and filers who have been following the organizing and mobilizing for this event, people are actually charting the course of where the Zim vessel is on their cell phones. There's a lot of chatter in the hall about it. People are very informed, and I think that that's the key thing in terms of really building up some long-standing understanding and solidarity support from the workers, is for them to become acquainted with the issues. Let me quickly say that ILWU Local 10 has a long and glorious history of respecting community picket lines. Monado referred to the 1930s with regard to Italy. In 1935, 1 year after the general strike in San Francisco, there was a community picket line that was put in place for the purpose of preventing scrap tin, nickel, brass that was destined for Italy after the Italian government had invaded Ethiopia. In the late 1930s, there was a community picket line placed to prevent the loading of scrap iron that was destined for Japan after it invaded Manchuria. We've taken actions to oppose the military regime of Pinochet in 1978. We refused to load military cargo in 1980 that was destined for El Salvador. And so it is in that tradition that I am hopeful that our rank and file will stand up again, once again, to take a firm position against the tyranny, against the oppression, against the mass murder of innocent women and children, attacks on educational facilities, hospitals. This cannot stand. And let me just say, personally, as an African-American trade unionist, I am I'm very touched by what's going on there, because I can say from my own experience of growing up in the black community here in the United States of America that the police department represents an occupying force in the community. They do not protect and serve. As we have witnessed in the action, in the events that have recently taken place in Ferguson, Missouri, where an unarmed black teenager was murdered, left in the streets for 4 hours. You wouldn't treat a dog that way. Our young people are being targeted all over the country. And this program that is called Urban Shield, where the Israeli government, the Israeli military has, or police department, serves as some kind of ambassador talking to police departments such as the police department in Boston, police department in Oakland, sharing ideas. And as Laura mentioned earlier, we need to put the spotlight on this, because when you view the events in Ferguson, it reminded you of what was taking place in the Middle East. And I also understand that brothers and sisters from Gaza have been tweeting people in Ferguson, letting them know how they can provide some type of antidote for the tear gas and other things. So it really does show that the rank and file, the grassroots, the people are making contact through social media to fight together.
And we're listening to Clarence Thomas. He's a rank-and-file member of ILWU. And also joining us from South Africa is ANUMSA, National Union of Metal Workers, International Director Shambuzo Pakati. And he and his union have taken a very strong position in solidarity with Palestinian workers and the Palestinian movement. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. First, let me start by saying that our view of the Israeli-Palestinian crisis is that it is not a religious war, and we have a problem in our country and all around the world where people base the issue on the Bible. Our case that we have been trying to put across to our counterparts throughout the world is that what is happening in Israel is similar to what was happening in South Africa, and that is why we have correctly categorized and characterized the Israeli regime as an apartheid state. But having said that, we want to say that we do not condone violence on either side, but what we are saying is let the workers of the world stand together united the same way that workers stood against apartheid South Africa by refusing to handle goods destined and coming from South Africa, by engaging in academic boycott, by engaging in economic sanctions, by engaging in arms embargo. And as South African workers, we have taken the lead in the continent to say, first, we have mobilized our academic institutions to boycott and break ties with Israeli academic institutions, and the University of Johannesburg is the first one to have cut those ties. We have in the country mobilized all companies and government departments that have contracts with the Israeli-linked and security company G4S, which is supporting and running the Israeli prison, to say we break those contracts with them. We have a company in South Africa called Cape Gate, which is also assisting with the Israel detention prison equipment, security prison, and we are running a campaign locally to say that company must be isolated. But we are calling on the workers of the world to stand united simply on the basis of human solidarity, to say we cannot allow innocent children, innocent women to be slaughtered in broad daylight and all of us pretend as if nothing is happening. And I'm happy that the workers of the United States are training and leading in this campaign, because we have been labeled sometimes as being anti-US when we say the weapons that are used in the murder of Palestinian people come from the United States. We are happy today to hear that coming from the workers of the United States, to say let us talk to our government, let us mobilize our government to isolate and refuse to be co-opted into mass murder. As South African workers, we are currently mobilizing and pressuring our own government to break ties, the diplomatic ties with Israel, to say that we recall our ambassador in Tel Aviv and the ambassador in Pretoria goes back to Israel. We believe that by so doing, as workers, the ordinary human beings of the world, will be doing our duty peacefully, to say we cannot allow oppression, we cannot allow brutalization of other human beings to continue right in our journey. In South Africa, we have a very large number of Jewish people who are saying this is not done in our name. Therefore, we want to say that we are ready and willing to join hands with everyone all around the world. We are joining our friends and allies in Europe who are beginning to speak up around the issue and to say, let us support a just cause, a cause that says no violence has a place in this world. We cannot allow workers, ordinary people, to be killed. But having understood the consequences and the issues that are at the table, to say both Hamas and the Israeli government must negotiate in good faith, and our leaders in South Africa, both former President Thabo Mbeki and former President W. de Klerk and current President Jacob Zuma, have said when called upon to assist, we will share our experiences with the people of Palestine and people of Israel on how to deal and resolve issues where everybody has lost hope. And we are saying there is hope for peace in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.